and welcome back to the Video Essay Podcast. I'm your host, Will DeGravio, and on today's show, I'm very pleased to rebroadcast the second conversation between Chloe Galibert-Lanet, Johannes Binotto, and Kevin B. Lee, originally published as part of Film Explorer's Video Essay Gallery. Today's conversation centers on the theme of online affects. You can watch the videos discussed until the 16th of July. Enjoy the show.
Podcast. Video Essay. Exhibition 2, Online Affects. Johannes Binotto. Chloe Galibert-Lanet. Kevin B. Lee. Production by Film Explorer.
Welcome back to this discussion about the second exhibition of our series about video essays with three curators, Kevin, Chloe, and Johannes. For the second one, the title that you choose is Online Affects. You can also start about the question of choice, but you managed to choose this video essay and to agree with this title.
Should I start? Yeah, I mean, certainly the subjectivities of the authors plays a huge role in this, but thinking about, yeah, the affective, but not only the affective, but the online affect, I think is what strikes me as a very strong defining quality of these three selections, because I think all three of these selections foreground the internet and the online experience as a major part of having to consider what are we experiencing when we watch a video essay, at least in the online context. And maybe this hasn't been considered as much as it could be considered, because at least historically, I mean, I sound like a dinosaur, but like in the 2006 or 2010s, you know, when I started making video essays, we're so focused on understanding what the filmic object was that we were analyzing, that I wasn't considering enough the experience of watching these video essays online and the role that the online interface, the online dimension had in facilitating my experience of watching video essays, of the kind of knowledge that was being produced and the overall effect of watching something online. And I think this has just become stronger and stronger over time. And I really think these three selections foreground the online experience as the thing to study itself. I mean, that's one way to justify it, because I think these selections maybe have the least use of found footage or filmic material of our selections. I mean, we could debate that. So that's a question of how much does that even matter anymore when we're talking about video essays?
The one that you picked, I mean, it's all found footage. But of course, it's not necessarily kind of like from source material that we would consider necessarily like worthy for film analysis, and certainly not from canonized material. But I think perhaps also to pick up on that, this kind of like, do these videos, as we are used to it in standard video essays, or what we often consider video essays, kind of like that they would refer to like a filmic object, do they even do that? And the answer would, again, I think in all those cases would be kind of like yes and no. It would be like perhaps no on a very literal sense. There's not like footage from classical films there, but what we see in the performances, they also make me think of all those films that are not present in these individual videos. It's more like a sort of like a background noise or something that is still around, even though you don't have to mention it anymore in a way. So, for example, in your pick, Kevin, I cannot help but, of course, also get a strong like Godfrey Reggio feeling when I'm watching this, right? I mean, it's... I could almost...
How dare you, Johannes? Bruce Conner, not Godfrey Reggio. Let's give her some credit here.
Yeah, but in Bruce Conner, I see more like conceptually what I take with me at like the ethos of like the message as a portray of existence. That's more like the connection that I saw. But perhaps I can connect this also to something that for me also links these three videos, and this has also to do actually with the topic of affect, namely that what I find interesting about affect, and this stands a little bit in contrast to a lot of discussions about affect, is that I would claim affect is always detached. Affect is not the direct link to like pure, raw subjectivity. And I pick up here on an idea actually from psychoanalysis, like a very simple observation by Freud, that he said, well, in dreams, we can have like a certain emotion. But then when I wake up, I realize the thing that gave me this emotion is not necessarily like linked to that. Things that I have to laugh about when I'm awake perhaps were frightening in the dream. So what he observes is like that the affect is always derailed. And that's actually what for me is so interesting about affects. There is no congruency between like subjectivity, how I define myself, and the affect, but there's always like a tension here. And that is something that I see in all three examples. Like also in your pick, Chloe, this seems like a little bit like watching in a group meditation and perhaps something that we first would consider, okay, this is the ultimate moment of like being in the present, of being in your own feelings and all that. But when I watch this, I also feel like strangely, of course, disconnected, because I think, what does this mean that I'm now watching this with my eyes open? Am I supposed to also close my eyes now for 15 minutes? Do I really care? And I also start to judge like the emotions of the people there, that I wonder, do they actually really feel something, or is this just like pretense? Is this just like performance? And then to see perhaps we have to move beyond that question. And I think that's also what my pick is so much about. Something can be at the same time a performance and real. Something can be at the same time fiction and documentary. Something can be at the same time like heartfelt emotion and totally detached, performed, learned emotion, learned from movies, from TV shows, and you cannot even tell the difference anymore.
Yeah, I want to pick up on this notion of performance, but before listening to you now, I think there's something that struck me also as a maybe a common denominator, or something that at least resonates why I chose to create this video, which arguably, again, is not your usual video essay. And I can say this with almost confidence that there was actually something that resembles more a video essay that was produced out of these online performances by Annie Abrams and Daniel Pinheiro. There is a 5-minute video essay that they made that was compiled into a longer video essays with other experiments that were conducted, and that was published in the Journal of Embodied Research. I'm saying it's more of a video essay because it actually has textual elements that comment upon the experiments. And I watched it and I was really interested, but I found it more interesting and more provocative to curate the raw recording of the performance in the context of this exhibition on video essays. The decision is precisely what you just said, Johannes, the fact that I didn't know how to watch it. And that's something that really intrigues me, the fact that it's a video that does not tell you what to make of it, because it is a raw recording of something that happened live in a moment that as a spectator, I was not part of. And I have this desire to be included while, of course, also not being part of the community that whose image is being recorded in the video and the people who actually participated in the performance. And I think there's something unstable about this experience that the video is creating when you're like, should I be watching? Should I close my eyes? Am I analyzing? Am I feeling? Can I do both? Which is perhaps the most interesting questions of them all. And I think this instability, I felt really strongly also with your two picks. In Johannes' picks, this video, you have this attempt at controlling the environment and performing this teaching with obviously a lot of humor and a lot of distance with the exercise that she's trying to perform. But this constant struggle with what your environment is throwing at you and your attempt at doing what you're supposed to be doing. Yeah, I felt it was very unstable. And also, of course, the very quick pacing of the edit, somehow reminiscent of like early YouTube vlogs as well. It's like jump cut in the middle of sentences. It gave me this feeling of, wow, okay, this performer is really trying to make the most of a situation that's super unstable around her. And I think in Kevin's pick, one thing that I really felt as I was rewatching it was the fact that the rhythm of the sound especially is never, ever stable. At first you could seem like, okay, it's a repetition, it's a loop, and it's not. It's like always getting just a little bit longer, but just the exact amount of time that you don't really notice, but is enough to make you feel like your heart cannot get in sync, because it's always like, you know, like always missing just a little bit or just a little bit too much time. It almost suffocated me, especially with the headphones on a small screen, because I was really trying to immerse, but then it almost gave me hiccups. I don't know how to say it. Like there was something in the rhythm that my body could not get into, which, well, I'm sure it was made on purpose. It was meant to create this sort of really uncomfortable experience as you were watching, and something that could be really soothing if just the rhythm had been a little more stable. And it could almost be like this sort of ASMR compilation of satisfying visual patterns, and, you know, an audio loop becomes exactly the opposite of that, super unsettling and really hard to feel comfortable with. Or at least that was my experience watching it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting contradiction, because the film 1001 Attempts to Be an Ocean is compiled of many, many ASMR videos that the author Wang Yuyan was watching during COVID and just as a way of kind of getting through life. And then what she does with that footage, in a way, produces the opposite effect of state of restlessness and discontentment. So again, it's using footage, a lot of footage. And yeah, maybe I single-handedly was trying to overcompensate with found footage, because there is an admitted lack of found footage, you know, within the video essays that the two of you proposed. But this is something I think is a really interesting question, because, you know, what these three examples for me put forward is that there is much about spectatorship as about, you know, what we're analyzing is states of spectatorship, specifically online spectatorship, which for me was like a big realization about what I was doing at some point, like, because for the first few years, I thought I was trying to understand cinema more with my video essays. But at some point I realized, oh no, actually I'm trying to understand spectatorship. I'm trying to understand my own experience as a viewer, or what it means to watch films or media, and using the video essay as a very powerful instrument for seeing that. But now looking at these examples, it's not even about, I mean, it's about spectatorship, but like spectatorship, not so much as something you watch, but something you feel. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about these three selections, is that the online state of viewership is as much about something that's bodily, that's neurological, that's psychological, rather than visual. And I think this creates a very interesting kind of answer to a question that I wanted to pose both of you, especially because, you know, I can practically hear Jason Mattel, who I think defined with Christian Keithley the term videographic as a very defining term for video essays in the academic context, that the videographic, you know, by definition, uses existing audiovisual material to produce a new critical insight. You know, we can argue different things, but I don't think he would consider these to be videographic works. So then it's a question of how much does the videographic matter in terms of understanding what a video essay is. So this is a question I would pose to both of you. If a video essay is not videographic, then what is it? And at least with these examples that you've proposed.
But perhaps, Joseph, just to pick up on what you said earlier, and that also then connects to a possible answer to your question. Again, that in a way, this is also, like, for me, it's also an interesting connection again to the beginnings of cinema. Namely, that of course, cinema at the beginning was much more just like considered as an experience, like the notion of like the cinema of attractions, in contrast to it's not about telling a story necessarily, but it's literally about the audience, let them feel affects that did not exist before. So I would also even think that goes even beyond this very simplified idea of like what is considered the Kuleshov effect, this idea of showing certain affects that we are familiar with, certain emotions in a montage form. I would say that was not the point about cinema. The cinema was about giving us emotions that we did not even know that we had them. And what I really liked about our three picks is literally the fact that, again, it gives me something that, of course, I remember what I also experienced in the cinema, namely just like the fact that I realized watching a film, watching a video is something visceral. It actually can make me sick. I had at some point, I had to stop, also for reasons that also, as Chloe M said, I had to stop 1001 Attempts to Be an Ocean at a certain point because I could not stand it anymore. And of course, that's really interesting. Or in Chloe's pick, I must confess that the first time I saw it, I also skipped at some point that I thought I can't stand this, watching this for 50 minutes. So, but it's really interesting because it showed me, okay, it does something to my body. And that was, and that perhaps that is also something that we forgot. So just to come back to your question, Kevin, I mean, true, like on a factual level, there is no found footage in those videos. But particularly in the case of like Diana McLeod's video that I proposed, it's obviously that all those things that she's talking about, theory, question of like gender, performativity, that is not something that is just like naturally there. But that is something that we learned. That is from text. In German, we would say Rosinenpicken. I mean, we're not just like counting the amount of material. I would always claim we cannot help, but always also quote what we do. Even then, when we pretend this is just like a raw performance of my heartfelt emotion, we cannot help but also kind of like quote the films that we saw. And we also cannot help that the audience of us, that they would be reminded of the films that they saw. So for me, videographic, it's much, things are much more often videographic than they are not.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, I relate to a lot of what was said just now, also in being primarily interested in thinking about spectatorship more so than the analysis of images themselves or their ontology, if that makes any sense. I'm not saying this is the only way to approach video essays as a way of working or as a mode of study, but in my interest, it's definitely more so the case that I'm interested in the video essay as a way to explore the mind of a spectator or spectators at work in front of or immersed in footage, more so than as a way to, as we were saying actually last time, more so than as a way of grasping the film material and exploring its materiality. Though again, I understand this to be another way of working that's also interesting. But I was thinking about this because as you were asking, Kevin, or the way that I would rephrase your question, you know, I asked myself, like, if I were to explain or to show, let's say, students what video essays are, would I be showing this video, this performance by Annie Abrams? And then, yeah, no, I would probably not, or at least not in the introduction course. So then why would I choose it for this curation? Do you know, the idea, the goal for this curation was to represent the form of the video essay in a way. And so I was thinking about this difference, like, why would I show it in one context and not the other? The justification that I found for myself relates very directly to what was discussed just now about the affects or the investigation of affects. And as I said earlier, like, I was interested in the spectatorial experience that this video creates, this, the recording of this live performance creates. And so what I would want to ask is not so much, is this video, the recording of the performance, is this video a video essay? Is this videographic? I would want to ask, can we watch this videographically? You know, and that would be my answer to the question. One thing that I'm interested in with video essays is the fact that when I watch them, it creates a time and space for me to think about what being a spectator means and the different ways of being a spectator. And I think this video did that to me. As I was watching it, it created 15 minutes for me to engage very directly and very physically to questions relating to what am I doing in front of this screen right now? What's going on in my mind? What's going on in my body? Why does this video exist? And why am I deciding to spend time with it? But then, is the video doing that, or am I doing that as a spectator? Like, am I producing the research, or is the video producing it? I don't know. Does it matter? I don't know. Yeah, I was willing to defend the idea that it was something to be learned from the experience of watching it. And I think this idea that when you're a spectator of video essays, you're also part, you're a participant of the research. It's not like the video is performing the entire argument and you're just receiving it. You are a participant because there is co-production of the meaning, I think is an idea that is quite prevalent in the discourses about videographic criticism. And maybe at the end of the day, it relates to this idea of performative research, the notion that Catherine Grant has been defending in relationship to videographic criticism, borrowing from Brad Haisman, this idea that there's something performative about the method of videographic research that makes a difference between this method and a written scholarship. And I think for me, there was something of this nature going on as I was watching this video, distant feelings, and that eventually justifies or explains why I decided to include it in this curation, despite the fact that it is in no means a typical video essay or something I would defend as the right way of making video essays.
You know, it's funny. It makes me think of, I have this discussion with the students that I ask them, why is it difficult to watch an experimental film? Because there's nothing easier than watching an experimental film, because they have a hard time with the fact that they, exactly what you said, and what I also very strongly experienced, that we do not know how to watch this piece. And I find this really interesting, because we should be aware, of course, that actually being able to follow a narrative, being able to understand continuity editing and all that, that was a learning process We're not born with that, but that's actually a skill. But we are so well-versed in that skill that we consider that's the easy thing to watch. Whereas if we're confronted with something that does not tell us, look, this is the story, this is the narrative, we find that really hard. Whereas in fact, we could also claim, well, nothing is easier than that. I can just watch it. There's no police telling me you're watching it the wrong way. You're not understanding it correctly. So for me, that very much like connects to the question of the video essay, this asking us, again, also what you already said, is kind of like, what does it mean to watch something? What are the strategies? What are the practices with which I'm viewing something? And of course, in my opinion, there are two possibilities that you can go. On the one hand, you can pick something, and I think many video essays that I find interesting do this. You can perhaps pick an example from like narrative cinema that is kind of like we're very familiar with, and then show, look, actually, the practice of viewing this piece is actually more complex, or we could watch it differently. We could see other things. We could more watch it like an experimental film. Or the other way is like the experimental film as such, that is not even like taking this detour, but just like confronting us directly with this situation of like, look, here is a piece that you don't know how to watch it. And that is what is actually interesting about it. So again, it comes to me also to the question, or just like the observation, why in video essays, in most of video essays, why experimental cinema is like not so much the topic. We have like these innumerous video essays about classical cinema, narrative cinema. And not so often we have like experimental film being the subject of video essays. And I often wonder about that. Why is that? And of course, the simple explanation would be, well, the other thing is more attractive. You get more clicks if you do a video essay about Paul Thomas Anderson than if you would do it about, like, I don't know, Bruce Conner. But perhaps it can also has to do with the fact that those experimental films, in a way, already they do something that the video essay also tries to attempt. And at least that's also the experience that I have. That I sometimes have a feeling of like almost like, what is there that I could add to that piece about giving you something to think about the practice of watching something when the piece already does this?
Right. Unless you were to make an explainer video out of it, right? That's probably like what people would be wanting most. Like, how do I watch Bruce Conner or experimental film? Which is, from what I take, Johannes, the least interesting proposition for you. We were talking just a moment ago, or Chloe was bringing up this question of performativity. I mean, that was, I think, early on in the conversation. And I want to come back to that because it's clear that there's a performative dimension in both of your selections, especially yours, Johannes. At the same time, a kind of resistance to performance. But I also have to think about my selection, 1001 Attempts to Be an Ocean, because there is no on-screen subject who you can see performing their spectatorship. The spectatorship is more like implied in the montage. So just thinking about where the performance exists in each of our selections, and then also what the nature of that performance is, because again, anti-performance, like with Chloe's selection, there's clearly a kind of anti-performance going on. Like, they're on screen, but they're doing nothing, right? Or they're doing something, but that something may or may not be nothing. And then, you know, Johannes, it's like very hyperactive, which is also kind of a reaction of being put in this very tense and a state of having to be an online performer in lockdown circumstances. And by doing that, she's expressing a kind of resistance or resentment to that, you know, and thinking about her needing to be active as a form of being helpless, being passive, like she has no choice but to perform in this Zoom environment. So your activity is not agency. It's not your choice. So then that connects to, 1001 Attempts to Be an Ocean in terms of, in some ways, it's the most old school in a way, because it reminds me of what Alejandro Bachman who's a programmer at the Austrian Film Museum in Vienna. He once said, I don't believe in this interactive media stuff. I think cinema is already very interactive because we're really not giving enough value and attention to what goes on in a spectator's mind when they watch a film. There's all this stuff going on. And maybe, yeah, 1001 Attempts to Be an Ocean gives an image to that. But at the same time, it's kind of a nightmare image because it's the opposite of probably what he was endorsing, because now you're not in a cinema anymore. Now you're just like an endless doom scroll of online media, and it's not putting you in this state of deep attention. It's kind of the opposite. I think it's kind of expressing this hyperactive passivity that maybe relates to the online scenario.
Yeah, I wanted to connect this because I'm not sure. I think it's the case in English. It's definitely the case in French that the word performance has different meanings and, you know, has actually very complex meanings, but refers to different things. And the video that I picked, it's a performance in the artistic sense, in the sense that we understand this genre of, you know, coming from live theater. And there's the term performance that's being used and discussed in the video that Johannes chose with reference to Judith Butler's writings about performativity and gender performativity. But there's another meaning that I see as a very clear line between the three videos, which is the performance in the sense of being competitive, achieving results. We say performant in French in that sense, but I'm not sure if in English you can say performant in that way. I don't know that if that adjective exists, but that would be effective or competitive or just achieving your goals. And that's a language that comes very directly from the universe of like liberal startups and economy. Exactly. And I would see this also as one of the things that is being performed in the video that Johannes chose, that the video is also a response to the demands that come from a certain economy and a certain state of academia that's expecting the teachers to be able to produce these teaching content and to maintain the relationship with the students in contexts that were absolutely impossible to manage for a lot of teachers and students finding themselves in this context of a distant learning. One of the things that I projected onto the faces of these people doing quote unquote nothing in the video that I chose was this. I did dream that this performance was happening, you know, somehow in the middle of a day of people working. And what does it mean to take this time off work, you know, this time off labor? And, you know, made me think, like, when was the last time that I took 15 minutes at work, not doing anything? Well, that doesn't happen. So I don't know. I wouldn't even know. What does it mean that this needs to be recorded? It needs to be something organized and something that is turned into a video product, you know, for this sort of relaxed, silent moments to exist in front of a screen. But then that would be also the way that I bring the video that Kevin picked as part of this discussion or thinking about performance as an expectation that's formulated by the economic system in which we exist and have to work. Because I do, and that's one of the reasons why I find the video so both effective and hard to stand, because I do see it as a form of very vivid expression of a form of anxiety that I definitely relate to these demands of being online in the sense of being connected, being awakened. You know, I go back to the audio of this piece that sort of obsessed me, but because it has this obsessiveness to it, because it has this pattern of obsessive repetition that I think is also one of the very concrete symptoms of that form of anxiety, that having too much to do and feeling like you're overwhelmed and you're repeating these sentences as a way to reassure yourself. I'm totally projecting here, but those are my associations with the contents of the work that I definitely felt like, okay. And of course, with the accumulation of images as well, it gives you this feeling like, okay, I have to watch all of this because it's out there and I need to be aware of it. And it's completely overwhelming. And so this idea of expectations and having to be your most productive self all the time, I think is part of one could call the online affect. And I think something that the videos that we picked manifest in their own singular ways.
There's something you said just now about having to watch all this stuff that really resonates and maybe justifies why this whole idea of the video graphic, we can kind of let go of it for a while. Because if it really is, and I do believe this, if it really is more urgent and important to understand spectatorship more than cinematic objects or media objects, I think our three selections really give a strong argument for why that's the case, why it's more important to understand spectatorship. Yeah, maybe we don't need to deal with existing images anymore, or we shouldn't let that be a prerequisite or a requirement for diagnosing states of spectatorship and states of viewing and states of subjectivity in this kind of reality that we're in now.
Quickly, also something that I had to think about in 1001 Way to Become an Ocean, that I wondered what I sort of like first really disliked was kind of like the gesture of that the video itself has like this gesture of like that we're just like watching this stuff, as you mentioned, like this doom scrolling, that's just like this endless stream. And I got, and I'm always suspicious of that, because I then also thought, well, but there are moments, there are clips that I find really intriguing that I would watch, that I would love to see. And who is really saying that? Of course, if I just watch from afar, everyone that just looks into their iPhones or into their computers, they really look like this, look like dystopia. But individually, it can be something very different. It can be actually something that we really engage with, just like one piece. And so there again, I totally agree with Chloe also that for me, the sound became so important, because I realized the sound is actually making a counter argument to what the visuals do. Namely, the sound is saying that, look, there can be within this seemingly just like constant repetition, there are these moments. I mean, eventually the sound changes and we have a different sound bite. I cannot reproduce it exactly, but it's something like you had a certain look, I think. I saw something in your face. There is a change in that. So nonetheless, with all our three pieces, I totally agree. That's very much like about the question of like, what does it mean to watch them, spectatorship? But I also must say, the reason why I picked mine, that this is just like a film, a video that really, really touched me. I just love to watch this one, and that I found really touching. And I can also kind of like, similarly in your pick, Chloe, we ask ourselves when we say there is nothing to see here. But of course, one answer would be then, of course, I start to think about myself, about what does it mean that I'm watching this and so on. But also, I could, of course, also realize there is numerous things to see. There's too much to see, actually, precisely. And again, I think that's one of the difficulties students have with experimental film. There's actually too much to see, because they realize, if I had a story, I just could pretend, look, I only have to concentrate on the protagonist. I only have to concentrate on what adds to the story. But once I realized there is no protagonist, there is no story, then like in a James Benning film, I realized, actually, there's far too much information here. And everything becomes important. So I also had very much this experience that actually I wanted to further inspect also these media objects. Yeah, again, I think that was also one of the things that I found first so frustrating in your pick, Kevin, that it does not allow me this time. But then I also realized I can pause this video. There's no police that's saying you are supposed to watch it like it is presented to you. I'm happy with the bibliography at the end. I will trace some of that footage that is used and also watch that.
I think Giuseppe and Ruth, you might have to disable the pause button for the video window, because I don't know, that might go against the wishes of the artist and they don't want that to happen. So thanks, Giuseppe, and thanks, Ruth.
Podcast. Video essay. Production by Film Explorer.